This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Ethics in government can be fuzzy. Whether or not they're important or what they look like seems to be up for debate among some people. Others, including my guest today, think they should be well-defined and followed for the sake of all of us. Jill Long Thompson is a former U.S. representative from Indiana's 4th District and ran against Mitch Daniels for governor in 2008. She's the author of the new book, The Character of American Democracy, Preserving Our Past, Protecting Our Future. Jill Long Thompson, it's great to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Matt. It is very nice to be on your show. Thank you.
And a quick note, today's show is pre-recorded, so we can't get your questions and comments to our guest, but you can always let us know what you think on our social media pages. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. So you set the scene by starting this book with a story from when you were working on Capitol Hill and you ran into a committee chairman who invited you to dinner. What happened?
Well, I was walking to my little rental apartment one evening after a long day of work at the Capitol and ran into a very powerful committee chairman. And he was standing in front of a very expensive restaurant, and he asked me if I would like to join him and others for dinner upstairs in a, it would have been in a private dining room. And I was concerned because I knew lobbyists would be paying for the meal, but I also knew that his power could make it possible for me to better serve the interests of the people of my congressional district. And it's important to form relationships if you want to get the work done. So I agreed to join him and the others for the dinner, but I chose not to eat and just ordered a Diet Coke. And the next day repaid one of the lobbyists who was paying for the dinner for that Diet Coke. Sitting across from me was a colleague and his wife, and she asked me why I wasn't eating. And I said, well, I'm not particularly hungry, but I also do not accept meals or even a cup of coffee or a Diet Coke from lobbyists because I want to make sure that my decisions are clean decisions and not influenced by the gifting of someone who has a special interest. And she looked puzzled and she said, well, we would never be able to eat in a restaurant this fine if we didn't accept meals from lobbyists. And over the years, I've had people say things to me like I couldn't be influenced by a meal. But in fact, we can be influenced by very small gestures of kindness or generosity. When I was a graduate student at Indiana University working on my doctorate, I came across a study that had been conducted by some faculty researchers at Yale, and they discovered that people who had access to peanuts and Pepsi while they were reading promotional materials were more likely than people who had nothing to eat or drink to then accept the position being promoted in the promotional material. The experimental group got peanuts and Pepsi while it read the material. The control group got nothing, and the experimental group, in a statistically significant way, adopted the position that was being sold to them in the promotional material, even though when the experiment started, neither the folks in the subjects in the experimental group or the control group had an opinion on the topic. If you can be influenced by peanuts and Pepsi, and I like peanuts and Pepsi, but if you can be influenced by those to change your mind, you could certainly be influenced by a fine meal in an expensive restaurant. And the reason that I think it's important that people who are in positions of power not accept gifts from special interests is in democracy, the power is to come from the people. And there were many people in my congressional district that would not have had the opportunity to provide that kind of opportunity for themselves to meet with a member of Congress, pay for an expensive dinner, and make their case on a particular issue. And so I think, and today it would be illegal. The law has been changed. And in fact, I introduced legislation when I was a member of Congress to prohibit that practice. My bill did not become law, but provisions that were in my bill did in fact become law, and today that would be illegal.
Do you see I don't know. Do you see that legislation threatened now in any way? Is there any chance of that sort of being overturned, or is that pretty much the precedent? That's where we are. That's where we'll stay.
Well, I think that it's unlikely that that will be overturned, because I think there would be a public outcry. But, you know, people are always looking for loopholes and ways around the law. And I think we have to also recognize that there is potential for creating a social event where a member of Congress, a member of the House or the Senate, or someone in a powerful position is socializing in a way that is beneficial to that person. And so even though it may not be specifically a member of Congress being bought a meal or expensive dinner from a lobbyist, we really have to be careful, I think, about keeping the appropriate distance between our decision making in high public office from being influenced by people who have a particular special interest that may not be in the public's broader interest.
We're talking with former U.S. Representative Jill Long Thompson. She's also a former gubernatorial candidate, and she's the author of the new book, The Character of American Democracy. So would you say that defining ethics in the democratic process, it's clearly been on your mind for a long time. I mean, you've taught it, you've helped shape policy around it. Why did you want to write this book about it?
I began to notice after President Trump took office that many of the norms in Washington were being tossed to the side. And I'd like to compare, for example, the beginning of his presidency with that of George Herbert Walker Bush. President George Herbert Walker Bush, in 1989, shortly after he was sworn into office, appointed a commission to do an analysis of ethics requirements in the executive branch, and they reported back to him with recommendations, and through an executive order, he issued the 14 ethical principles for people who work in the executive branch, for executive branch employees. He was very serious about ethics, I believe. But we saw things going on from the very beginning with the current president, where he would deliberately make false statements or misleading statements. And if someone in the independent media, the independent press, criticized something that he or someone in his administration did, he would try to discredit the media. And we also saw circumstances where he would have his children at dinner parties with foreign leaders, and then a short time later, they would get some kind of business advantage in the country of that leader. And I began to become very concerned when I heard people say, I didn't vote for someone to be chief Boy Scout, or even since writing the book, just several weeks ago, there was a congressman from North Carolina who was being interviewed about the problems at Liberty University, and he was calling for the president, Jerry Falwell Jr., to step down. And he was asked about this congressman was asked about the president's morality. And he said something along the lines of, well, he's not the most moral person, but morality is not relevant to leadership. In fact, it is very relevant to leadership in a democracy, because democracy is an ethical concept, and as I mentioned earlier, it is a form of government where the power is vested in the people, and it requires those who are in leadership positions to consider the varied interests of all. The process has to be fair. There has to be equality of participation, or at least equality for the opportunity to participate. There must be transparency. For example, the Constitution requires both the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate to maintain a journal of their proceedings. That sounds a little antiquated because when the Constitution was written, of course, we didn't have radio or television or the internet, but it was considered so important that it's a constitutional requirement. There's also the requirement that the president, and this is in the Constitution, deliver a State of the Union to the public every year, and or regularly, I believe, is, I'm not sure that there's a specific time on it, but required to deliver a State of the Union, providing information to the public on what is happening in the government, what is happening in our country. And so you cannot separate ethics from democracy because the very foundation of democracy is ethical principles.
Going back to the 14 principles of ethical conduct for federal employees, aren't the president and vice president exempt from those because of the Hatch Act of 1939? And what I guess is the reasoning for that?
They are, the president and vice president are correct, or you are correct. The president and vice president are exempt from the 14 principles and also from the Hatch Act.
And just so you know, we have only about a minute left in this segment, but I want to make sure that we continue it in the next segment if your answer is a little more broad, as I expect it might be.
I would like us to be able to continue it, but as I understand it, and I've talked with a number of lawyers, I have a PhD, I do not have a law degree, but it is my understanding that they are exempt because it would be very challenging to enforce those rules regarding the president and vice president, since the president actually has control over the Department of Justice. But I think, and when we return, I'd like to talk about some ideas regarding how we could hold the president and vice president to those same principles.
All right. We're talking to former Congresswoman Jill Long Thompson about her new book, The Character of American Democracy. And when we return, we will talk a little bit more about the Hatch Act and some modern changes that we could make to hold the president and the vice president accountable. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back with former U.S. Representative from Indiana's 4th District, Jill Long Thompson, talking about her new book, The Character of American Democracy, Preserving Our Past, Protecting Our Future. And just before we took the break, Jill, we were talking about the Hatch Act and what many people have pointed to, the president being exempt from the 14 principles of ethical conduct, or rather, those, I guess, are not, they're not exactly laws. They're just sort of principles put in place by George H.W. Bush.
But they have been codified.
They have been codified.
Actually, they have been codified. Mm-hmm.
All right. And so you, just before we went to break, you were talking about some ways that we could hold the president and the vice president accountable, whatever president may be, the current president or future presidents accountable, even though that according to the Hatch Act of 1939, they're exempt. So what would that look like?
Well, let me first of all talk about why it's difficult to do that. One is, as I mentioned just before the break, that the president oversees the Justice Department, appoints the Attorney General, and has some authority to oversee what happens in the Department of Justice. And it would be very difficult, I think, to expect realistically that someone who is appointed by the president, who is not heading an independent agency, would be able to actually enforce those kinds of provisions as they would pertain to activities by the president. And I think there are lawyers who could give you a better explanation than I can, but let me give sort of a basic understanding. The problem is that we never really expected that we would have someone who would not adhere to these 14 principles. And Donald Trump sets an example that is very different from the presidents who have served since George Herbert Walker Bush executed that order making those principles basically the rule, and then they've been codified. So it occurs to me that there may be a number of ways to hold the president and vice president accountable. And it might be that we would want some kind of independent commission. And this would not be an easy thing to make work. But if you had an equal number of Democrats and an equal number of Republicans on the commission, they could potentially be objective in determining if something that the president or vice president has done is not consistent with what would be considered democratic leadership and would be consistent with those 14 principles. Let me talk about a couple of those principles and give you an example from my own experience. You cannot make a decision if you are a public official in the federal executive branch. You cannot make a decision that would impact your own interests. And when I was appointed to serve as a board member at the Farm Credit Administration, and I was ultimately promoted to board chair and CEO, but when I was appointed to that position by President Barack Obama, I was required to file a great deal of paperwork on my husband's and my financial holdings and our finances. And one of the questions that I had to answer was, did we have any loans that had been made? Had we borrowed money from any of the institutions that make up the Farm Credit System? Because the Farm Credit Administration is the regulatory agency that oversees the compliance by the Farm Credit System, compliance with the law. And neither my husband nor I had ever borrowed money from the Farm Credit System. His father had been a lending officer many years ago with the Farm Credit System, and his father passed away in the early 1970s, but neither he nor I had ever borrowed from the system. But I decided that we needed to look further because Don had invested in an ethanol plant, and I wasn't sure if it had borrowed any money from the Farm Credit System. So I asked him to check that out, and he did his research, and he came back and he said, as a matter of fact, they did, which meant that he held equity shares in an ethanol plant that had borrowed from the Farm Credit System. So I immediately took that information to the ethics officer at the Farm Credit Administration, and she said he will have to liquidate those, and rightly so, because it would put me in the position of wanting to make a decision that benefited him potentially over the safety and soundness of the Farm Credit System and in the best interest of the public. The Farm Credit System is government-sponsored enterprise, and how it is overseen, how it is regulated, is of interest to the public. So he said, okay, he would sell them, but they weren't publicly traded, so he couldn't find a buyer. And so we were told that then they could be gifted to a family member, a non-dependent family member who is not in business with either of us, or could be gifted to a charity. And so that's what he did. But if you think about the power that a president has, if a president is able to hold financial interests that conflict with the public interest and there is no way to intervene or to stop that, then potentially our foreign policy or our trade policy are going to be influenced by what is in that president's interest rather than in the public's interest. And since going back to George Herbert Walker Bush, presidents have pretty much put their holdings in a blind trust or in some kind of mutual fund where they would not have that kind of interest. But this president has refused to do that. In addition, he refuses to release his tax returns, even though all modern day presidents have done that as well. And so we don't know when he's making a foreign policy decision or economic decision regarding international relationships and trade. We don't know if he's making those decisions in the best interest of the public or in his own personal interest. And so we really do need to work to find a way to hold the president and the vice president accountable, they have considerable power. And we need to make sure that the power that they have is not abused to benefit themselves personally at a cost to the public.
We're talking with Jill Long Thompson, a former U.S. representative from Indiana's 4th District. She's also a former Indiana gubernatorial candidate, and she's the author of the new book, The Character of American Democracy. This moment right now is not the only ethical crisis we've seen when it comes to how our government operates. Can we compare this moment to others in fairly recent memory? I'm thinking of like the last 50 years or maybe even 60 years. Can we look at that and through the lens of today, I guess, and spot some differences or similarities or alarming comparisons?
I think that we can. And in my book, I point out that I came of age. I personally can remember 60 years ago, I was out registering voters with my mom in 1958. So I can remember 60 years ago. But I remember the Pentagon Papers, and I remember learning that we were being lied to regarding the Vietnam War. And I also remember Watergate as it was unfolding as a story, and as Congress was working to address, figuring out how to address that issue. I don't think I have ever seen anything like what we see now, this latent disregard for the principles of democracy. We can't expect our representatives, our leaders, to be perfect. We're humans, and humans are not perfect. So we're not looking for perfection, but we are looking for leadership that understands the role that ethics play in democracy, in running our country, because if they violate ethical principles that interfere with democratic values, like the power of the people, power from the ground up, fairness of process, equality of participation, transparency, we need to know what our government leaders are doing, because we are ultimately the ones who are in charge. And so I don't think there's any question when we see, for example, the numbers that show that we have a president who, since taking office in January of 2017 to early July of this year, made 20,000 false and misleading statements to the public. That is a problem. Transparency and honesty, openness, those are very important to the democratic process. And when you have leaders who blatantly disregard those principles of democracy, you're undermining the democratic process and ultimately undermining democracy itself. So when we look to elect leaders, we need to look at not only where they stand on the issues, that's important, but we need to see how ethical they are in terms of upholding the ethical principles of democracy.
How has this debate around ethics in the way we conduct government become this partisan?
Well, I think that it's probably a combination of factors. I can't answer them all, but I think that for some people who are in elective office or hold powerful positions as appointees, they want to hang on to their jobs. But I also think that many citizens do not put forth the effort that is needed to be a responsible citizen and voter. Voting is a right, but with it comes responsibilities. And I like to refer to pillars of character. Character, I love the word character. It comes from the Greek language and means a marking or an imprint on a coin. And that imprint, of course, denotes the value of that coin. I like to think of human character as the imprint that we make on our world. And the more character we show in how we conduct our business, the more character we show in running our government, the better the imprint that we make on our world. And while people who have different religious beliefs or moral values often think we can't come to an agreement on ethics or morality because we have different points of view, we actually can at least come to an agreement on ethics in democracy because of the ethical principles that form the foundation of democracy. And in my classes, I like to talk about pillars of character. Pillars of character have been identified as characteristics that across the world, people believe reflect behavior and a life lived with character. They are trustworthiness, respect, responsibility, fairness, caring, and good citizenship. And if you look at those six pillars and think about them, they are pillars of democracy, because trustworthiness is critical to democracy, since we have to have an open process in order to protect that right of participation. Respect for others. Our government exists for we the people, not me the person. And one of the frustrations that I have is when you have a leader who divides us, then respect for others starts to fade. And you see this on both sides. You see it among those who are very conservative. You see it among those who are very liberal. You see it from people who are in the middle. When we are making a decision here in the United States, I don't get my way necessarily, and you don't get your way necessarily. The only time I get my way is when, through compromise, it's a compromise position that fits with people who have different ideas. And when people think they should have their way, that is counter to democracy. When people say, I won't compromise, that is counter to democracy. I don't get my own country. I don't get my own state. I don't get my own county. I don't get my own president or governor or senator or U.S. representative. I share all of those with my fellow citizens. And we must have respect for others, even when we disagree with them. We also have responsibilities. We have the responsibility to be informed and to do our homework and to recognize that democracy is about finding democratic ways to solutions that we need in order to keep our country safe and have a strong economy and a healthy, educated citizenry. The process has to be fair. These six pillars of character, fairness, that is central to democracy. And caring about others. I think sometimes we forget just how much democracy is about other people and not just about us. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But we can find, I think, statements from many leaders on both sides of the aisle that have shown this commitment that we have to others and our need to care about others. Let me read this quote. I pulled this out before you called me. This is a quote from President Ronald Reagan when he was delivering a Presidential Medal of Freedom. He said, "We lead the world because, unique among nations, we draw our people, our strength, from every country and corner of the world. And by doing so, we continuously renew and enrich our nation. While other countries cling to the stale past, here in America, we breathe life into dreams. We create the future, and the world follows us into tomorrow. Thanks to each wave of new arrivals to this land of opportunity, we're a nation forever young, forever bursting with energy and new ideas, and always on the cutting edge, always leading the world to the next frontier. This quality is vital to our future as a nation. If we ever closed the door to new Americans, our leadership in the world would soon be lost. And I think those words reflect not only the importance of having policies that keep refreshing us as a country, but also it's the value of who we are. We care about other people. And then finally, the sixth pillar of character, citizenship. Citizenship sort of encompasses all of the other five, but we have responsibilities to know the candidates, to know the issues, and to be truly committed to the democratic process.
We're talking to former Congresswoman Jill Long Thompson about her new book, The Character of American Democracy. Today's show is pre-recorded, so we can't get your questions or comments to our guest, but you can still interact with the show on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. And we will be back with Jill Long Thompson in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we are on with Jill Long Thompson, a former U.S. representative from Indiana's 4th District. She was also a former Indiana gubernatorial candidate who ran against Mitch Daniels in 2008, and she is the author of the new book, The Character of American Democracy, Preserving Our Past and Protecting Our Future. Jill Long Thompson, can you explain micro versus macro ethics?
Yes, I can. I explain that frequently in the classroom. Microethics refer to specific behaviors, and macroethics refer to the consequences, if you will, of our of how we behave. So a microethics issue would be if you are a business person, you should never pad your business expense claim, but should only put in a claim for exactly what you have spent. It would also mean that if you are working with a client, that you would never mislead a client about the specifics of your product and what your product is able to do. And microethics would be complying with, for example, the laws that impact the business that you are running. Macroethics would refer to the possibility of you might follow every rule in a micro way, but in doing so that you end up hurting a particular segment of the population. I like to use as an example something that I worked on many years ago writing my doctoral dissertation. I wrote the dissertation in the late 1970s and early 1980s, and sugared cereals were a relatively new product on the market. That sounds like a long, long time ago, but I think it's a good example. And so you could be a cereal producer and be following every law and providing good information on the inputs of your product. And you could be advertising them honestly. And at the same time, because they're sugared, you could be building up a demand for more sugar in the diet than would be healthy for children. So in a micro sense, you're being ethical, but in a macro sense, you're probably not being so ethical. The same could be said of environmental impact. You may be in full compliance with environmental law, but you may be polluting the environment in a way that's contributing to global warming. You might be killing off some fish. You could be contaminating the soil in a way that is going to have broad and long-term damage. So when we make decisions, we always need to recognize that the law is the bare minimum, and we can be in complete compliance with the law and with the rules that have been created by us. But if we are doing some long-term damage, then we have the potential for, then we are not being macro-ethical, and we have the potential for doing some broad and long-term damage. And I think that in the context of running a democracy, it's always important for us to look at not just whether somebody is technically in compliance with the law, is what they're doing going to undermine the democratic process and democracy in the long run? And that would be a macro ethical issue that is very, very serious for us as a nation.
You're doing a wonderful job of explaining it. I appreciate it. And you do teach ethics at IU.
I'm actually taking a break right now, but the last 5 years I taught ethics at the Kelly School of Business and for the O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs.
Okay, so let me rephrase. You have taught ethics at IU.
I
took a few ethics courses when I was in college, of course, and I remember the subject matter being pretty vague. Important, of course, I learned a lot, but vague. It's hard to talk broadly about something like that. I like your approach. What would you say your approach is?
Well, I think that I am a little bit analytical, and I think that it is important to understand the reason for ethics, and then to have a means by which I can analyze whether something is going to be ethical or unethical. And let me give you what is my favorite definition of ethics: well-based standards of right and wrong that prescribe what people ought to do in terms of virtues, duties, and outcomes. And I think that this is a very good definition. And it also gives us a framework for determining if something is ethical or if something that we are about to do is ethical. I use an example in the book that's very simple, and I think it probably hits home with lots of people. I use as an example my mother and her cousin who grew up during the Great Depression, and they aren't doing this so much these days, but for a number of years they would get together on Saturday at a favorite restaurant that had free refills of coffee. And my mother's cousin would drive and my mother would buy lunch. So my mother's cousin would pick her up, they would go have lunch, and my mother would buy the lunch. And they only ordered one cup of coffee for the two of them. Because there were free refills, my mother would ask at the end of lunch for a free refill to go, and she would be given the free refill, and she would carry it very discreetly out of the restaurant and give it to her cousin. And when she told me she did that, I said, "Mom, that's not ethical." And she said, "But they have free refills." And I said, "Mom, if you go to an all-you-can-eat buffet, does that mean all you can eat or all you and the rest of the people at your table can eat?" She said, well, I want to be responsible. I want to be fiscally responsible. And I said, let's work through this. Is it virtuous? Are you being completely honest with yourself and with the restaurant about where that coffee is going? And is it principled? And what are the outcomes? And in terms of outcomes, if 50% of the people who went to that restaurant did what you did, ultimately the restaurant would have to raise the price of coffee for all of the other customers. And I said, so the outcome is not a positive outcome. Now, let me give another side to this. They grew up during the Depression, as I mentioned before. They were taught to stretch a dollar as young kids, and they want to make sure that they're not wasting money or coffee. So I think it's important to understand their perspective. But very honestly, if you go to a restaurant and you get a refill that's for you, if you think it's virtuous, you'd probably hand it over to another person right then rather than wait till you got out to the car to give it to them, right? And so I think we need to always stop and ask ourselves if something we are about to do is reflective of virtues like trustworthiness and respect for others and personal responsibility and fairness and so forth. And then what duties do we have in the role that we're playing? What duties do we have at work? What duties do we have to our family? And then who's going to be impacted by what we do? And what's that impact going to be? And particularly in government work, the outcome is very important because we're in a democracy, and how people are impacted by the decisions that our leaders make, that's significant. That's what we're all about.
We're talking with former Congresswoman Jill Long Thompson, who was a U.S. representative from Indiana's 4th District. She was also an Indiana gubernatorial candidate for the Democratic Party in 2008. She's the author of The Character of American Democracy, Preserving Our Past, Protecting Our Future, which just came out. We were just talking about kind of your approach to teaching ethics. Now, do you or have you gotten any surprising or even alarming questions about ethics from your students?
Well, I've actually found it incredibly rewarding. And I'll give you an example, a specific example. Early in a semester, it's not unusual for me to hear a story like this. After we start talking about ethics, I had a student say that he had moved into an apartment and had ordered some flooring. And when it arrived, it was an incomplete order. So he contacted the company and they said they would send the balance that had not been included in the first order. But when he received the second delivery, it actually was a complete order. And he said, before I took this class, I would have taken both the partial order and the complete order. But now that I'm in this class, I called the company and I sent back the part enough to make it so that it was exactly what I had paid for. And I have to tell you, when I hear students talk about those things, I am just so encouraged. Of course, I'm always encouraged when I talk with young people with their dedication and optimism, and they make me, actually, their optimism is very contagious, make me feel optimistic about the future. But every semester I have had students come up to me and say, I see things differently now as a result of this class, and I will make different decisions as a result of this class. And my colleagues hear the same thing. It's not just because of my specific teaching, but it's the exposure to these concepts.
Before he passed in July, I wanted to make sure I got to this. Your then forthcoming book, it's now out. It got some praise from the late Congressman John Lewis. What was it like to get that endorsement?
I have such high regard for him as a leader, as a person. I was so privileged to know him from when I was serving in Congress. And occasionally I would run into him as I was walking from my little apartment to the Capitol. And we might walk up the last block together. And he had such humility and all that humility, and yet all that courage and all of that intelligence. He had this very complex way of looking at the world and recognizing the challenges that we face. And he had this ability to figure out how to address complex problems and find solutions and build support and coalitions around doing what is right. And when I contacted him to ask if he would be willing to take a look at the book and maybe write a statement about it. And I actually got a response fairly quickly. I felt incredibly honored and blessed and fortunate that someone with his capability and someone who was living the life that he was living, and we've now lost him, but I felt so honored.
I think that it's easy right now to feel like we've reached a sort of point of no return on how partisan things have gotten, how divided we are politically. Are you a little more optimistic?
I am more optimistic. I believe very much that we have the potential to correct these things, but I'm very serious about my recognition that we are only as strong as our citizenry. People can blame elected officials all they want, but we put them in office. And very frankly, the equation is undeniable. How we conduct ourselves as a citizenry will determine how our leaders conduct themselves. And if we say things like, well, I like their policies, I don't like their ethics, I don't like the way they do things, but I like their policies, then we are ignoring the very basic principles of democracy and the very significant role that we play in electing our leaders and in participating in the democratic process. We must demand of our leaders that they not be divisive, that they show respect for all of us, that they are honest in how they conduct their business, that they speak the truth when they talk to us, but we must demand that they conduct business in an honest kind of way, because all of those things are central to democracy. And when we don't demand that, we are contributing to the undermining of this great country, the United States of America, the greatest experiment in democracy. And each of us has this responsibility to support leaders who are ethical and who also understand policy and will fight for what is right for the country, not for a select few, and not to enhance their own personal wealth.
We have just a couple minutes left. I wanted to make sure I asked you this. Politics used to be something that we didn't really talk about unless we really knew the other person or unless somehow we got into it. Now it's so easy to go on social media and just send our view out there and then let everyone else kind of fight about it. How should we be talking about politics, and what should we know about what politics are that will help us do that?
Well, I think if we're going to talk to others in person or on social media, that we should conduct ourselves and frame our messages so that we are showing respect for others that with whom we disagree, that we are being responsible, that we are being fair, and we are being caring about the needs that others have. But I also think we need to be honest with ourselves about where we get our information. There's research that shows that false information travels through social media at a faster rate and more broadly than the truth. If you're getting your information from social media, just get off of social media and find a legitimate news source. And I am a very strong supporter of public radio and public television, where, yes, of course, mistakes get made from time to time, but the commitment is to the truth. And we cannot survive if people keep making their decisions based on falsehoods. And so we need to demand the truth from our leaders. We need to demand the truth from our sources of information, and we need to demand the truth from ourselves.
We've been talking with former U.S. Representative from Indiana's 4th District and 2008 Democratic gubernatorial candidate Jill Long Thompson about her new book, The Character of American Democracy, Preserving Our Past, Protecting Our Future. Jill Long Thompson, thank you for your time today.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for all of your work that you do to get good information out to us, the citizenry.
I appreciate that. And if you would like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it wherever you get podcasts. Follow us for topic alerts and discussion on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelzer. Thanks for listening. This is All In.